If you're joining us tonight by way of our podcast, we want you to know that we're absolutely thrilled that you've joined us. Some of you are listening to this podcast in the year 2015, while others are listening to it maybe 3 or 4 years later. So regardless of when you're listening to this or where you are, we want you to know that we are so pleased that you have chosen to join us for this very meaningful conversation. We are now weeks into the process, and we have weeks to go, but we find ourselves having richer and richer dialogue and conversation as we go deeper into the conversation. And so welcome to those of you that are here live, as well as our podcasters. Tonight, I want to say again how grateful Tabernacle Baptist Church is to have Dr. Art Wright and Dr. Tracy Hartman as they are helping guide us through this very meaningful time together. And so if you're listening along, I hope you'll open your Bibles to join us as Dr. Wright leads us through various passages. Tonight we're in the New Testament. And so without further ado, will you all join me in welcoming Dr. Art Wright?
You guys embarrass me. Thank you. Thanks for your hospitality. Good evening. I wonder if you will just take about 30 seconds or so to look at the ground rules that are printed on the table in front of you as we are, again, talking about sensitive topics tonight. So just take a second to glance through those as a reminder of the rules and parameters that we put in place for this conversation. So we are transitioning now to talking about sex in the New Testament, sex and sexuality, and we inevitably talk about marriage in this conversation. So we'll say sex, sexuality, and marriage, and we'll probably talk about some other things along the way too. We have 2 weeks to do this. And once again, I discovered this so much to say, so little time, but we're going to do the best we can. This week, I want to talk a little bit, and the mic sounds really loud or hot to me. It sounds okay? Okay, all right. That's a good mic. So this week, we're going to talk a little bit more broadly about sex and sexuality and marriage in the New Testament. And so I gave you 5 bullet points that kind of sketch out what I'm hoping to cover tonight. We'll talk just briefly about what the incarnation means in terms of how we view sex and our bodies. Then we'll talk very generally about how much the New Testament writers actually talk about sex, because I think that's relevant to the conversation. We'll delve a little bit into the historical context of the first century Roman Empire and just kind of check in on their views of sex and marriage and love. I'll tell you what I mean by the apocalyptic mindset of earliest Christians in a little bit. And then we're going to spend a big chunk of our time, probably the majority of our time, talking about Paul's texts, especially in 1 Corinthians on sex and desire. So we will actually be reading big chunks of 1 Corinthians tonight. And then next week, we inevitably have to be selective about what we choose to talk about with the time that we have. I think this is a significant enough topic that we're going to devote most of next week to it. We will talk about same-sex sexual activity in the New Testament next week. All right? So that's where we're headed over these next couple of weeks. So I wonder if we can just start maybe for 2 or 3 minutes with some table conversation. What do you think are some of the biggest points the New Testament authors make about sex or sexuality? And I'm not putting you on the spot. I'm not asking you to betray your amazing Bible knowledge or lack of Bible knowledge. I'm just kind of wondering what your impressions are. What you think the New Testament authors might say about sex and sexuality. So what are your impressions? What texts come to mind when we raise this issue? So let me just give you, we'll see, 3 minutes to talk at your tables, all right? All right, let's see what you think. And again, no shame here, all right? This is a safe zone. It's okay just to share impressions. And I'm just kind of curious what you're thinking. Can we actually, I wonder if we can just kind of hit each table just briefly and share one or two things that you think that the Bible or the New Testament might say about sex or sexuality. Interesting. Okay, so wondering if Paul is the only one to address sex or sexuality at all. Yeah, good rumination. Yes. it's better to marry than to burn. not burn in hell, but burn with passion, or be inflamed with lust or whatever. Yeah. Yes. And once again, Paul, right? And we'll see that text tonight. All right. Anything else, y'all? All right. That was it. All right. There was something about Jesus and sex. The Da Vinci Code. Different book. Jesus and the prostitute, and they're about to stone. Yes, and they're about to stone this woman. She's actually not described as a prostitute, but a woman accused or caught in adultery. The question that kind of always wanders through my mind when that text comes up is, where's the guy? One wonders if maybe it's a setup in some way, either to test Jesus or maybe the woman has been duped into this situation too. Good text. Anything else that y'all... Yeah, if you even lust after a woman, you've committed adultery in your heart. Yeah, and we'll see that tonight too. Teenagers everywhere recoil. Adults too, probably. table in the back. Jesus doesn't really say a lot about it. That's, yep. I'm glad that you think that, because I'm going to think that too, and so I'm glad you're backing me up on what I'm about to say. So maybe lots of discussion in Paul's letter specifically about sexual ethics in the church. Yep, fornication and lots of fornication, yes. Or you shouldn't be fornicating, yes. We'll see a few passages like that tonight, too. Good. All right. Did you guys? Prostitution is mentioned. Yes, an acknowledgement that prostitution is a regular thing that exists in that culture. Yep. You got it? Okay. Yeah. I overheard y'all, I hope that's okay, it was not eavesdropping, but I heard y'all mention the vice lists where Paul just kind of goes and beware of immorality and sexual immorality and idolatry and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And so it certainly shows up in these vice lists that's a common literary device in the ancient world to kind of list everything wrong that people might participate in. It's interesting. I think there's some sense in this vice list that is trying to kind of catch us all in that web, too. We like to single out other people's vices, but usually we can find ourselves in those lists, too. All right. Good. Good. So that's a good place to start. Y'all share a lot of the same impressions that I had coming in the New Testament. So one point I want to make up just up front is in the New Testament, we see a fundamental embracing of bodies and flesh. And we see that, I think, in two critical ways, in the incarnation and in the resurrection. And so we see in the incarnation, this divine being taking up residence in body and flesh. Incarnation, incarne, literally in meat or in fleshed. And this is not the only option or worldview at the time of the New Testament. We have different philosophical systems like Gnosticism, Docetism, and Platonism that tend to view body as bad, spirit or soul as good. So there's a countercultural trend in the New Testament already that embraces the goodness of flesh just simply by claiming that in Jesus we see the divine presence in a body, in a human body, in flesh. So just a couple texts that point to this reality. John 1, 1, 2, and 14, a very clear text that points towards this. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we've seen his glory. Philippians 2, 5, verses 5 through 8, let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness, and being found in human form, he humbled himself. So Jensen says, at the heart of the Christian faith is a wondrous claim that word becomes flesh and dwells among us. This divine embrace of human flesh extends to the blessing of sexual life, not as something to escape in order to attain salvation, but to nurture as we grow in faith. So Jensen says, sex matters for Christians. And so I said the incarnation, we also see this acceptance of bodies and flesh in the resurrection. So Jesus dies, is buried, and comes back to life. And he's not a spirit creature, right? He's not just kind of floating around like an angelic being. He doesn't discard his body. And, he invites Thomas to reach inside his body and touch him. He eats with his disciples. It is evidently a transformed body, but it's still physical. It's still whole. It's not some sexless angelic being or spirit that Jesus shows up as post-resurrection. So Jensen says, the resurrection reminds us that our bodies are not husks to be discarded, obstacles along the path toward communion with God, but heralds of the renewal of all God-given flesh. All right, second point I want to make is, and we've already alluded to this, thank you. Sex, at least in my estimation, in my reading of the New Testament, I skimmed the whole New Testament just before tonight. Just kidding. It doesn't seem like it's that big of a concern. Jesus doesn't have much to say about it. He's not walking around the countryside of Israel on some great crusade against sex and sexuality and sexual immorality. He doesn't spend much time at all preaching about sex or sexual immorality. This is kind of what I came up with on Jesus and sex and marriage. This text from Matthew 19, actually verses 3-6. And it's a test from the Pharisees. They say, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause? And Jesus says, have you not read that the one who made them at the beginning made them male and female? For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they're no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. So he does make this statement about marriage and implicitly sex within this response to the Pharisees. But he's not laying out a systematic theology of marriage here, right? He's responding to this one particular question, and he's going to go ahead and make some allowances for divorce later on, too. We do see Jesus making several comments about divorce. I give you the text, the scriptures on the screen, and we don't have time to delve into them. Matthew 5, 31-32, Matthew 19, 9, Mark 10, verses 11 and 12, and Luke 16, verse 18. And so I pulled this out because in some senses, of course, it inevitably relates to marriage and sex. We do see the text that someone mentioned, comments on adultery and lust from Matthew 5, 27-28. So Jesus says, this is the middle of the Sermon on the Mount. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust, notice the fact that it's directed to men here in this text. But everyone that looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And I will be quite honest, I'm not really sure what to do with this text. I already joked that teenagers probably shift uncomfortably in their seats when they hear this. I think a lot of us adults do too. I do think there's a sense this Greek word for lust, epithumeo, has a desire with an element of covetousness to it. So it perhaps signals some intent to possess. So there's maybe not just the feeling, but the intention there. But I think it's an extreme statement, perhaps, that Jesus said for the shock value. And his point that he's, I think, trying to make in is that there's certainly a concern for the intent of our hearts on such matters. All right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, okay, so the comment for podcast listeners was that Jimmy Carter, while he was the sitting president, gave an interview for Playboy magazine in which he admitted to lusting or feeling lustful towards women or some such thing, and it caused a big scandal and uproar. So, yeah, my assumption is that most of us could in this room could probably make that claim too, all right? not something we usually say aloud. All right. So very few comments from Jesus in the realm of sex and sexuality. What are Jesus's priorities? Overwhelmingly, he cares about the kingdom or reign of God. He talks about matters of justice, economics, poverty, money, hospitality, inclusion, and acceptance of marginalized persons, but just doesn't have much to say about sex. Paul does talk a little bit about sex, and he tends to, when the question comes up, he tends to be dealing with specific problems that are arising in the churches. So remember, he's overseeing this network of churches that he's founded, and so maybe your church writes and says, we've got a guy that's living with his father's wife. What do we do with this guy in the church? And so then Paul puts pen to paper and responds, and so most of his concerns about sex or addressing specific situations. But we will talk a little bit more in detail about him. I think it's interesting, largely his emphasis is elsewhere. And just as an example, I pulled out this text from Romans chapter 12. And this is at a pivotal point in the book of Romans. God knows I'm still struggling to understand the book of Romans, but chapters 1 through 11, he lays out this deep theological discussion, and then he pivots at chapter 12 to talk on how we ought to live as followers of Christ in light of God's mercy, in light of everything that he's just been talking about. And so we get to this chapter 12, and he's talking about how we ought to live now. And I don't think I'll read all of this. I'll just read some highlights. But the point is, he's not going to say anything explicitly about sex here, okay? So Romans 12:3, for by grace given to me, I say to everyone among you to not think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. Let your love be genuine. Hate what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with mutual affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Rejoice in hope, be patient in suffering, bless those who persecute you, live in harmony with one another, do not be haughty, do not claim to be wiser than you are, do not repay evil for evil, and so forth and so forth. Is there anything in here that talks explicitly about sex or sexuality or sexual mandates? I don't see it. So here he is saying, this is how you live as a Christian in light of this that I've just spent 11 chapters unpacking. He doesn't talk about sex and sexuality. But do you see anything in here that might inform how we approach sex and sexuality? Yeah, I think so. Look for the best in others. Seek unity. Love with genuineness and so forth. So certainly there are values that undergird this section that are going to inform how we approach sex and sexuality. What's that comment, dare I ask? Do not lag in zeal. Yes, that could be the one explicit statement about sex in that list. There you go. It's what? 25 minutes in and I'm blushing. So, all right. So overall, in my estimation, sex is not an especially prominent topic in the New Testament. And this certainly contrasts with our current cultural climate, what I would say is our cultural obsession with sex. And I think there's a sense, too, that churches are obsessed with sex. And this often leads to extreme viewpoints on the matter. So I pulled out three right at the bottom of the screen here. I think on the one hand, churches that are obsessed with sex make it taboo to talk about. They just ignore it altogether, pretend it doesn't exist, or at least not exist here. Two, I think some churches, because they're obsessed with sex or sexuality, make it into the holy of holies. It's the most important thing to one's personhood and spiritual life. So then one's sexual purity becomes a sort of litmus test for one's faithfulness to God. We don't do that with things like money that Jesus talked an awful lot about. We don't have any sort of litmus test for whether you're greedy or not. But sexuality is often a litmus test for one's faithfulness to God. And then three, I think sometimes churches make it into this sort of gatekeeper issue. So what's your stance on sexuality, or maybe homosexuality in particular? I know a lot of interviewees, when they go to accept a call for a church, get asked this question. A lot of folks that are looking to join a church ask this question: what's your church's stance on homosexuality? And so there's a sense in this sort of perspective that if we don't agree on this topic or if we don't agree on this issue, we can't worship together, we can't serve together, and so forth and so forth. And so that's what I mean by some churches make it into this sort of gatekeeper issue above every other issue. That's just kind of where we're at. None of these views, whether on making sex taboo or a holy of holies or a gatekeeper issue, reflect the perspective of sex and sexuality as presented in the New Testament. All right? And I think we'll get around to this question. Why do you think it is that sex and sexuality are often the issue when it comes to churches today? Why is that the topic that we're obsessed with? Why does it become that gatekeeper issue? We won't talk about it now, but it should be on our radar as we think about what's next. And of course, we said from the outset, you know, we're doing a 13-week series on sex, so we inevitably run the risk of elevating the importance of sex and sexuality to the most important thing. So, I realize I'm sort of contradicting myself, but our intent is to emphasize sex only to put it in its proper perspective, which is not the most important thing. When we said the four pillars of the church are worship, mission, fellowship, and discipleship, we're not adding a fifth pillar there. All right, let me shift gears just a little bit and talk about marriage and sex in the first century Roman Empire and today. Some interesting things. Age of marriage was very young in the first century. Perhaps 12 or 13 if you're a young woman, and you'd often be betrothed before that. So your dad is like, I think you'd be a good match for this family for whatever reason. And so by the time you turn 12 or 13, you're ready to get hitched. I'm just curious, what do you think the average age of marriage today is in the U.S.? 24, 26, 27? 30? Okay, good. It's certainly getting older as young people delay marriage later and later. This is what Google said, so I assume it's exactly right. I should check Wikipedia. That's right. So Google said that the average age for women in the United States today is 27 and 29 years old for men. Other fun facts, the average age of menarche today, menarche is a woman's first menstruation, which signals the beginning of fertility, is 12.5 years. So, and boys hit puberty a little bit later on average than women, but there's variation. So I think it's interesting to think about this fact. If you're living in the first century Roman Empire, especially as a woman, you hit the age of fertility, and then you're married. In most cases, in 2015 in America, especially young women become fertile, and then on average, there's 15 years between the beginning of puberty and the time that they get married. So interesting gap, big change in cultural context here. And so as I was thinking about this, it's interesting to think premarital sexual activity is not on their radar in the same way that it's on our radar today. Very interesting. There's not really enough time to have premarital sex in the first century. As a woman, yes. The window's very narrow, if at all. And this is one of the big questions that I kind of personally brought to the table that I've been thinking about. And this is one of the questions that we put on the table week one. And I'll just be honest with you. I haven't made up my mind yet. I don't know where I fall on this issue. I used to know, and I find myself kind of in a time of questioning on this. But as best as I can tell, I'll make this statement. There's no explicit mandate in Scripture against premarital sex. I'll say that one more time. As best as I can tell, there's no explicit mandate in Scripture against premarital sex. Now I'm going to walk back on that just a little bit. We did see last week in an Old Testament passage that virginity was highly prized for women. Okay, if you're a woman, well, you don't have much say in the matter, but if you're a man and you have children, you want your daughters to be virgins because there's a sense that they're more valuable in that way. And we saw in Deuteronomy 22, 20 to 21, a husband could have his new wife stoned if she didn't bleed on their wedding night as they consummated their marriage. One of the main concerns there is paternity issues. Who's the father of the child that the woman delivers? There's no DNA testing in the first century, nor is there birth control, right? And it affects inheritance. Who gets my stuff when I die? What's that? It's always about money. Yeah, it's chiefly an economic concern. I should say it's primarily an economic concern, probably less a purity concern. Yeah, and the comment is it seems to all apply to women. Yeah, we saw in the Old Testament texts not a lot of emphasis on this value of virginity for men. I will be the first to say it makes me kind of uncomfortable to say this in front of you all. It's not necessarily something that I came to the New Testament expecting to find either. But I will say this too, what we see in the New Testament are texts that seem to assume that the primary, if not exclusive, context for sexual activity should be within marriage. Let me say that one more time. What I think we do see in the New Testament are texts that seem to assume that the primary, if not exclusive, context of sexual activity will be within marriage. And so we did, for example, see that already in Matthew 19, verses 3 to 6. And of course, the New Testament authors have a great deal to say about controlling one's desires, faithfulness within covenantal relations and relationships and so forth and so forth. Yeah. We're going to talk about that. How did Paul define fornication? Well, I'll give you the answer. He didn't really. Yeah, sorry, Paul. Yeah. Yeah, it's a narrowing the gap, yeah. It probably puts undue pressure on men, too. I would imagine that, you know, women, you know, I'm assuming that there's some equality in sexual attraction there. It's not just the men. But yeah, so the comment was that there are some movements within churches to try to push the age of marrying earlier so that this gap of 15 years narrows. Yep. So I hope you get the distinction I'm trying to draw here. I think there's no explicit mandate against premarital sex, but I think there are assumptions. And of course, we know that assumptions are often conditioned by cultural context. But so I'm trying to navigate these waters. And to be honest, Tracy and I haven't talked about this, so I have no idea where we're going to end up on this. My hunch is that we're not going to answer it, and we're going to let you be good Baptists and make your own decisions about it. But I think this does create some tension or even contradict the way that the church has historically talked about marriage and approached the topic of premarital sex. And this is kind of what I've heard in churches, is that the Bible says, don't have sex before you're married. I haven't found that verse that it says that. So I just don't know that it says that explicitly. Don't hear me saying more than I am trying to say here. I just think that it warrants a lengthier discussion, and we will likely come back around to it. All right. Just a couple more historical things. So major cultural differences between the first century Roman Empire and now between love and marriage. In the first century, they don't go together like a horse and carriage. Dun 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 dun. Go. Interesting. So go home and listen to the what. So I'm almost too young to remember this show. What it's Married with Children. Thank you. Yes. So, all right. I'm not sure my parents let me watch it. So in first century, primarily marriages for procreation. It's in order to have offspring to inherit your property, to carry on your bloodline. Marriages are often arranged, so you might not have a say. Today, you know, marriage is about love and relationship. I don't know, maybe you have similar taste in music or politics or enjoy spending time together. But you have some say in who you marry, and it's usually for love, not to have kids. Of course, I'm saying these are the primary values. Certainly some people today still get married in order to have kids or as the result of having kids. And probably in the first century, even if you're in an arranged marriage, it's certainly possible or even likely that you grow to be extremely affectionate and love that person. All right. But again, it's a matter of primary values. The primary value for marriage purpose of marriage is not because you love someone, but it's in order to have offspring. All right, let me just say, we're going to turn and look at Paul more specifically. And so we need to set this up a little bit with sort of the worldview of early Christians. And on the screen, I've kind of sketched out, this is kind of the way that early Christians think that time works. You'll see on the left side of the screen, this age, meaning the here and the now, when folks were living in the first century. And then this Christ event happens. Jesus is born, ministers, does miracles, is killed and is resurrected. And in Jesus' life, ministry, death, and resurrection, he inaugurates the age to come. So very significant, pivotal moment in history in the mindset of early Christians. Now, early Christians believe that this age and the age to come overlap at this point. So the age to come has been inaugurated, but it's not fully come to fruition. And we're still, in many senses, living in this age. Sin still exists, death still exists, and so forth and so forth. At some point in the future, early Christians believed Jesus would come back. We call this the second coming. In Greek, it's called the parousia, or appearance. And so at some point in the future, Jesus will come back and fully end this age that we're living in now and fully inaugurate the age to come. And this is when things really get good, right? This is kind of the age when they talk about an abundance of wine and food and no sin and no dying anymore. So good things are going on. And the early Christians, this is really important, thought that it was going to happen really, really soon. So Jesus dies, resurrected, hangs out for 40 days, ascends into heaven, and then any day now he's going to be back. And we see a glimpse of this in Paul's letter to the Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians 4, 16 and 17. He's describing Jesus' return. And in verse 17, he says, "Then we who are alive, who are left," and notice the "we," he's including himself in that. So even Paul thinks Jesus is going to return any day now. And this informs the sexual ethics of Paul and the early Christians. It's I'll give it a little bit away, but it's almost as if there's not enough time for sex, all right? Because Jesus is going to be back, we need to put all of our emphasis on living faithfully and spreading the good news. All right. So matters of sex and marriage become very prominent in chapters 6 and 7 of 1 Corinthians. So we'll spend a little bit more time looking at them in detail. And I recognize this is a lot of text on the screen, but I will read most of it. So 1 Corinthians 6, picking up at verse 12, "All things are lawful for me." Notice the quotation. Paul is quoting something that the Corinthians said, and then he's responding to them. So all things are lawful to us, Corinthians, right? And Paul says, "But not all things are beneficial. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be dominated by anything." And then he gives a couple of points. Food is meant for the stomach, and the stomach for food. The body is meant not for fornication. There's our word, porneia, Greek word, but for the Lord and Lord for the body. And God raised the Lord and will also raise us by his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Should I therefore take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Do you not know that whoever is united to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For it is said, the two shall become one flesh. But anyone united with the Lord becomes one spirit with him. Shun fornication, again that word porneia. Every sin that a person commits is outside the body, but the fornicator sins against the body itself. Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, which you have from God, and that you are not your own? For you are bought with a price, therefore glorify God with your body. So evidently, some Corinthians were suggesting that it's okay to visit prostitutes for sexual pleasure. Not uncommon in the first century world. And they were probably making this point, we have freedom in Christ. It's okay. We can do whatever we want. Well, yes, but they're probably taking it a little bit too far. There's a sense, and this is Paul's response, that our bodies don't belong to ourselves or anything else that would possess them. Now, and we see this in our modern culture perspective on sex, this kind of view that I can do whatever I want with my body because it's my private property, as long as I don't hurt others. And even in some Christian perspectives on sex, we hear this sort of language, I shouldn't give myself away sexually until I find the right one. But Paul contests both of these sorts of notions in a sense by asserting that our bodies actually belong to God. So in a sense, our bodies aren't ours to give in the first place, and this should inform our sexual ethics. All right, yes, yes, ma'am. Yes. Yeah, so this word, often translated fornication, the Greek word porneia, is I think here in this text in 1 Corinthians 6, he's certainly talking about having sexual activity with a prostitute. Elsewhere, it is undefined. It's just a very culturally conditioned word that means very generally sexual immorality. And so we know that certainly definitions of sexual immorality change from place to place, from time to time. And so inevitably, people have read into it what they want the text to say. But I wonder if, we've been fond of saying in our Revelation Sunday School class, this requires wisdom, or this too requires wisdom. I think that it places a burden on us to think critically about what we think sexual immorality is in our own context. So I don't think Paul lets us off the hook. I think he presses us to think a little bit critically about what we think sexual immorality is. So, yep. Yeah. It's interesting, the emphasis is all on me here and what I'm doing with the prostitute, not me, Art, but me, the person in the text. But yes, the text seems to show very little or no concern to the prostitute. Yeah, it's a good point. There's no other focus. Yeah, it's very much about what I'm doing with my body, not what I'm doing with her body or his body. All right. All right. You got me twice tonight. I got me twice. Yes. So it often seems like there are some arbitrary sexual rules in place, like you can only have sex in the missionary position or whatever. And there's no scriptural basis for this, but this is sort of reading our own culturally conditioned sexual ethic into the text, or just making it say whatever you want it to say. Yep. Yeah, it's evidently called the missionary position because this is the appropriate, approved position that missionaries would pass on to some indigenous populations. This is the best way to have sex, or the only ethical way to have sex. And very interesting that it's man on top, the dominant person in the sexual relationship. So emphasis on male dominance there. All right, let's talk a little bit about 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And so Paul, in this section of 1 Corinthians, is very pragmatic. He's very concerned with unity and integrity of the church. The Corinthian church is fractured with division, infighting, and so forth and so forth. And so you'll see Paul offering his opinion, but then he makes concessions. It's almost as if he's sort of hedging his bets as he works his way through this. So he says, 1 Corinthians 7, 1, now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it's well for a man not to touch a woman. So notice here, this is something he's quoting back at them. And apparently some Corinthian men have adopted this lifestyle of celibacy. They might be married and they're like, well, but we're not going to have sex with our wives. So this is a sort of ascetic viewpoint. Don't touch anyone or be physically intimate with anyone. And they write Paul offering his seeking his wisdom on the matter for what to do. So Paul says, but because of cases of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give her give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. Wife doesn't have authority over her own body, but the husband does. The husband doesn't have authority over his body, but the wife does. Notice the mutuality there. So good job, Paul. Do not deprive one another except, yeah, maybe, perhaps, by agreement for a set time to go pray and then come back together. All right. I always heard that you're not supposed to pray with some of the opposite sex because it might lead to sex. So anyways, it's interesting to note here that Paul seems to be suggesting that the primary reason for marriage and sex with your spouse is to avoid sexual immorality. And here we see kind of a glimpse of this apocalyptic worldview. Jesus is going to return any day. We're minimizing the importance of sex and sexuality in Paul's mind, I think. So the only reason you'd want to have sex is if you just can't stand it. All right? So Paul goes on to say in verse 6, I say this by way of concession, not command. So here we see he's hedging his bets a little bit. I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has a particular gift from God. Verse 8, to the unmarried and the widows, I say it's well for them to remain unmarried as I am. But if they can't practice self-control, they should marry, for it's better to marry than to be aflame with passion. So this is what one of y'all said earlier. So for Paul, in a sense, marriage and sex is sort of the lesser of two evils. It's better to remain unmarried and celibate, but if you have uncontrollable sexual desire, it's better to get married and have sex. Right. Yeah, so what's Paul's motive here? And I do wonder if he maybe doesn't give us humans enough credit. I'm kind of wondering about that. What's that? Yeah, this Corinthian letter must be pretty juicy. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, it's crazy to think that maybe in marriage you don't need self-control too. Yeah, marriage is not a cure-all for sexual desire. Anytime, any place. Yep. So, so Paul's overriding concern is to control desires so they don't get out of control, and it's not really a resounding affirmation of the goodness of sex or marriage by Paul, but he gives us a clue why he thinks it's better to remain unmarried as we read on. So chapter 7, verse 25. Now concerning virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give my opinion as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. So no, he says explicitly, this is what I think. This is my own opinion. I think that in the view of the impending crisis, and what he means by this is Jesus' imminent return, it is well for you to remain as you are. If you're married, great. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife, unmarried? Do not seek a wife. But if you do marry, we're not going to call that sin. If a virgin marries, she doesn't sin. Yet those who marry will experience distress in this life, and I would spare you of that. So I think we should read this during the next time I perform a wedding ceremony. I'll probably read this. He says in verse 29, I mean, brothers and sisters, the appointed time has grown short. I'm not going to read the rest for the sake of time. But so, yeah, thanks. Jesus is going to return so soon. There's no sense of be fruitful and multiply here. We've lost that. But he does say, you know, if you get married, that's okay. If you remain unmarried, that's okay. There are options here. All right, I think I'm going to skip that for the sake of time. It's a little bit more of the same. So as we move out of Paul and into the pastoral epistles, we see a little bit of a shift or a counter viewpoint that seems to be present. So with in 1 Corinthians, there seems to be too much urgency about Jesus' return to worry about having a family and so forth and so forth. Now, the pastoral epistles, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, are believed by some scholars to have been written later by a follower of Paul, so maybe a generation after Paul wrote his letters. It becomes clear to these Christians in the late first century that Jesus hasn't returned yet. We thought he was going to return any day, but he might not return anytime soon because he hasn't returned yet. So there's a sense that churches appear to be settling in for the long haul. And so in the pastoral epistles, we see the assumption that Christians are getting married, they are having children, they're having, you know, good families, at least according to the culture of the time. All right. Good question. Yeah, so where does the emphasis... Yeah, where does kind of the concern about the state of one's marriage to one's partner or whatever enter the picture in terms of, I think we're going to get to that in a couple, maybe 3 weeks. We'll talk a little bit more explicitly. In some senses, this is laying the groundwork for what we're going to keep talking about. I think some of it's scriptural, and then I think some of it's culturally conditioned expectations. I think some of both. I gave you a couple passages where Paul does call out porneia, sexual immorality or fornication. So Galatians 5, 19 to 21, 1 Thessalonians 4, 3 to 5. We kind of already talked a little bit about that. And so we do see this exhortation that Christians should be sexually moral. I already said this may require wisdom and discernment on our part. Let me.
I like a little bit of a code, though. You look at the rest of that list and what we tend to ignore in that list, what we tend to emphasize in that list.
Yeah, so what do we ignore in this vice list in Galatians 5, 19 to 21? There's a sense that it's a catch-all. We might not all raise our hands for porneia, fornication, but I don't even know what licentiousness means, but idolatry or strife or jealousy or anger or quarrels or dissensions or factions, envy, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these. So he kind of leaves a other category for you to fill in your particular vice. Yeah, it's a catch-all. I can't even mention them all. There's so many. So, well, let me see what other questions or comments you have. We have a few minutes left on the clock. I've raised some big questions. I've tried to make some claims and answers. But what do you think? Where's your mind on this? Yes? Interesting. So 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 3, "For this is the will of God, your sanctification, the abstain from porneia, sexual immorality, that each one of you know how to control your own bodiness in holiness and honor." I would like to believe this, we as humans have that ability, not with lustful passion like the Gentiles who do not. Yeah, it does seem like he's maybe a little bit of a contradiction or tension, at least, between the two texts. Good.
You know, he talks about this thorn in the flesh, this thing that he talked about.
So what is Paul's thorn in the flesh? And some have wondered if maybe it is actual flesh. Yeah, temptation or lust or whatever. Good comment. Yes, sir, in the back. The things we think when we're 20 are not the things we think when we're 40. Yeah, and concerns change in perspective. Yeah. I think it's bigger than sex, but it includes sex, sexuality or whatever. Yeah, it's kind of an embrace of all, you know, all that it means to be human with a physical body, the incarnation. But I think you raised a really helpful point. Paul's writing his letters over a number of years, so he writes 1 Thessalonians, generally regarded like late 40s, so what, 20, not even 20 years after Jesus, 15 or so. And then he writes 1 Corinthians later, and so maybe there may be a sense that his viewpoint changes or adapts over time, but it's also important to remember he's writing to a specific situation and responding pastorally. He's never laying out a total theology of sexuality. He's responding to specific instances. And so kind of what we see in Paul's writings are glimpses of what he thinks, not the total package or the total picture. So that's, yeah, really helpful. Right. Yeah, Paul doesn't develop his theology of sex because that's not the most important thing for him. The most important thing is spreading the good news. And really his overriding concern is unity and whatnot in churches. During this section of 1 Corinthians that we saw, he's really trying to hold the church together, a church that's threatening to fracture. And so he's addressing this issue as a means of kind of patching this situation up. So it's ultimately not about sex, even though he's talking about sex. It's ultimately, I think, about how do we maintain the unity and integrity of the church. And yeah. Yeah, so maybe he didn't address other big questions like the institution of slavery or cultural perspectives on women because he thought that Jesus was coming back any day and there's not time to kind of throw your weight behind systemic change in that direction. Yeah, good comment. All right, we're done, I think. Good questions, good comments. Thanks for your honesty and openness. We put some more big questions on the table that we'll come back around to. I can't promise you we have answers, but we will talk about it, and Tracy and I will be as honest as possible as we can as we wrestle with them. So thank you.